You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is Stuart Goldsmith. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast, and it's 2024, and I did almost nothing to celebrate Christmas or the New Year in podcast terms. I had a very nice time with my family. Thank you very much. In this episode, James Acaster returns to the show, and this is a two-parter. We're going to drop both parts of these in quick succession, so you won't have long to wait. But what can we say about James? Lovely James Acaster needs no introduction, because if you're listening to this pod, you will know him intimately. If you are someone who's only just discovered him, oh boy, arguably best of his generation. Not my words. Yeah, my words, but everyone else's words as well. In the first half of this two-part special, and if you join the Insiders Club right now, you can watch the entire episode, both parts, on actual video, in my actual kitchen. Very much not a studio, but good camera quality. The link is in the bio. Why am I saying bio? They're the show notes. The link's in the show notes. We're going to discuss embarking around the country with the Off Menu live tour, what with him and friend of the pod, friend of mine, Ed Gamble. We're going to talk about developing the phenomenally successful format for television and why that might not be the best way to go. So we're going to get stuck into this. This is the first half. It's a two-parter. Please welcome back to the show, James Acaster.
Hello.
Hello, Stu.
Hey, man. I feel like this is, I'm not used to doing it all with the video stuff, so I kind of get my head in my pants about, like, would we normally be sitting this close in a conversation?
Well, all this sort of stuff, isn't it? It's like, you get used to it as it goes on, but initially, being an open spot and doing podcasts and just suddenly, like, having a normal chat and then going into your podcast chat and noticing the shift.
Yeah.
And then with videos, it's a bit...
I always find the moment when... the thing that I hope I'm not doing is when you're at a gig, an open mic or kind of, you know, first 5 years-y kind of a gig, and you check, it's in a pub, it's like a Mirth Control type gig, and then you talk to some bloke who's doing the sound, and he goes, I'll introduce you, and he goes, ladies and gentlemen, and he just does this the most phenomenal gear shift into that thing. And then I've done that myself at like a kid's party, so I was like, can you make an announcement? And suddenly you go, hi everybody, and you do a version of yourself.
Yeah.
Which is...
You want to start saying you're a genie. That's what you want to do. Just say you're a genie on the podcast, and then that's easy.
Does that help? Is the genie distinct from you, distinct from performing you?
Maybe.
Like, how many yous have you got?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I mean, with the podcast, I thought... And Ed always brings it up and makes fun of me for it. But I thought, well, we'll probably do 10 episodes and that'll be it, because no one's going to listen to this or, you know, whatever. So it was just, I think at the beginning, it was, what do we think is funny? Or what do you think is... You know, so I was like, I want to say I'm a genie. And the other two were like, don't say you're a genie. And then when we did the first intro, we called it the first intro before the first guest arrived, and I said I was a genie in it. I think Ed even says in the intro something like, well, I guess we are running with that then, if you're going to, or whatever. So we'll see if James remains a genie for the whole thing. So it wasn't really...
Could it just
something I thought was funny.
Could you stop being a genie?
During the podcast?
Yeah. The run of the potential future life of the podcast, which is about to embark on a massive sold-out tour... as you continue, you and Ed both continue to live this life where you travel anywhere in the world and are offered the finest of everything, as befits your genie status.
Thank you.
But what are the kind of the parameters of the podcast? Do you feel it would break a magical thing Are you inclined to go, I can't be a genie anymore?
Yeah, I think
would they accept it? Would they accept it because they accept you? Or is it that weird uncharted territory of like, maybe I'd break the magic thing?
Some people would accept it, some people wouldn't, I guess. But like, I can't see it being necessary to do that. You know, to just go, kind of go, I'm going to stop saying that. Because it's such a, it's a fun element of the, for one, it's actually become quite useful. Because people often have, it's crazy, like for a podcast which is purely hypothetical and all imaginary anyway, but how people do want to know, the guests want to know, like, okay, like, do I still get drunk or do I get full? Yeah. And like, am I still allergic to wheat? And you can just say, oh, he's a genie, so we can take that away. And even the most educated of guests just go, okay, good. And he's a genie, so I won't get full. That's good. And he's a genius, so he can, like, you know, get my old grandmother's lasagna and he can bring it back and whatever. So I think it's just a nice thing to have in the podcast. And then also, I really like the running things on the podcast of, like, whenever someone can, you know, so every now and again someone will comment on the genie's entrance, mm-hmm. and they, you know, we have to put them in an improv kind of situation where they've got to describe it to the listener. Yeah, yeah. And that's really fun. And so, yeah, and also because it's not really... It's not like I'm being a genie for the whole thing, really.
No, fair.
A lot of the time, there's a guest who really wants to seriously talk about food and, you know, and like important issues. I don't just go like, well, I can make them go away or whatever. Like, I do just listen like a normal person. And a lot of the time, just be myself and then you kind of switch it in and out of.
There is something really lovely about the fact that that was a whim that's become a core element of a show.
Yeah.
Like, there's something that's quite, whatever a less crap way of saying organic is. Do you know what I mean? That, like, it's got that daffy quality that you manage really well. Are there any downsides? While we're on off menu, are there any downsides at all to an incredible show which is massively famous that means anywhere in the world people in restaurants recognise you and want to give you the best stuff?
Not any actual downsides that are worth legitimately complaining about at all. No, nothing. Like, I remember once being somewhere, I went somewhere for lunch, it was like 12, and I was like, I'm going to go in here, I'm just going to get a small lunch because, you know, I ate way too much shit yesterday, and I'll just get some small healthy plates here. And they sent over loads of extra stuff that I hadn't asked for because they know the podcast. And I was, in my head, like, oh, fuck's sake. And then was like, now come on, man, you can't complain about this, you really love this restaurant, I bet this is delicious. And yeah, it's lunch and you're like, guys, it's fucking midday, I'm like eating all this shit, but like, I was like, no, it's nice. And and yeah, if this is what you're complaining about now in life, then what a life. So yeah, I'm fine with it.
And what are your expectations of the tour? You've done live ones before.
Yeah,
but these are monster rooms.
Yeah, I mean, just really looking forward to it. Like, the ones we did at Southbank Centre, the audience has become another kind of guest or person on the podcast. It's like an entity that can respond to the guest's choices. So we had Izzy Sooty choose Thai red curry. And then we got to see in the audience, like, who prefers Thai red curry, who prefers Thai green curry, and all that stuff, which I love. Like, so many people, I guess, it's very easy to make fun of podcasts and how, like, you know, just talking about trivial shit like it's important. I love talking about trivial shit like it's important. And I love that, like, especially with food. And it's great to have a room full of people who also just enjoy. Mm. And they know it's not just trivial, it is important. And Thai green curry is better than Thai red curry. But then Thai red curry with duck, actually that is better. I would rather have a Thai red curry with duck than Thai green curry. And then you get to think about food. So like, and they'll boo other people's choices if they don't like a certain choice, or they'll applaud it. And that was really fun on Southbank. So I'm looking forward to that on the tour and having, like, getting those reactions live to people's food choices and opinions on food.
I think an element of this conversation will, because of the nature of the show, because of Heckler's Welcome, which I saw last night, and obviously loved, and we talked about that, we'll talk more about it. That's me doing a podcaster thing.
That's
so
good.
it doesn't look like I'm going, heckler's welcome,
dot, dot, dot.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm also leaning forwards more now. So I'm trying to sort of notice myself doing kind of unnatural things that I'm doing. Because I'm, you know, obviously hundreds and hundreds of hours of interview experience, far less of it in front of the camera. So I'm like, sure. God, I mean, self-consciously annoying.
But also, like, we're both people who will self-analyse out loud.
Oh, Christ on a bike.
As is proven by our text yesterday on our WhatsApp, when both of us noticed the other was typing. So then wrote about how the other was typing, sent that at the same time.
It was really great.
Both doing this kind of like, oh, I'm going to do a meta on the other person's typing, but we were both doing it. Oh, God.
And you said, what did you say?
I think I said, Jesus Christ, or fuck's sake. I was like, oh, man.
Easy, lads. It was one of them, yeah.
Yeah, come on, lads.
It was a very beautiful moment. What I was going to say was, an element of this interview will cover the fact of why you do stand-up or why you still do stand-up and your relationship to it. If the previous show was kind of therapy-inflected, it was a sort of an emotional journey and a response to a therapeutic journey, this show is sort of, I think, in some ways, a sort of a triumphant, it's like a celebration of a, if not a conclusion of a therapy journey, then certainly of having learned some fucking great stuff about yourself, accepted it, and felt good about it. One of the questions, I've got a ton of audience questions for later on, and one of them, or a couple of them, are to do with this idea of like, if he hates stand-up so much, why does he still do it? Which I'm sure you've fielded before, and we could talk about that, but it just occurs to me while we're on off menu, that more than most things, I mean, more than your existing body of work, your books, all the rest of it, off menu sort of gives you the opportunity to perform on your own terms with no pressure, without having to write anything. It's one of those perfect kind of podcast systems where you're like, oh, the fact that that has been massively successful out of, I don't know, other podcasts or stuff you've tried, the fact that that has become like a global phenomenon, presumably, were you want to give yourself a break from stand-up, you could just go, I could just be the off menu guy forever and it would be incredible. Yeah. And you'd be loaded as fuck, your words. Loaded to fuck, your words. I remember, I enjoyed that. And you'd be able to perform with your friend in front of audiences who cherish you and not prepare anything and not feel bad. And presume, as we've said, there's no downside of any of that. Mm-hmm. So it's just quite interesting to me that, like, if whoever comedian was here and it seemed like, oh, they've got a complicated relationship with stand-up and one of the questions is, maybe I don't want to do it anymore, you more than most have got like, you could literally just do that instead.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, like, yeah, definitely realised writing and performing this show was like, this isn't, I don't want them to think that there are any stakes here, really, because there aren't anymore. Like, so I don't want them to feel bad for me or anything like that. It's just, this is about, like, I've got to be better and improve and stop being a dick. Because... Yeah. I can just stop doing this whenever I want, so stop whinging about it, because I am so lucky with this podcast now, and that, you know, there's loads of things that have to align for that to happen, and like a huge one is the people you do it with, and like, you know, just incredibly lucky that Ed and Ben are like so on it, and you know, I'm probably the worst when it comes to, you know, reading the emails and actually knowing what we're doing. And yeah, I mean, It does mean that we get to be funny on our own terms, talk about something we really like. Like, every day there'll be something. Like, me and you were talking about coffee before this and how much I love coffee at the minute. And when I am thinking about that sort of stuff in my day-to-day life, I kind of think, oh, how lucky I am that I get to do something about food that celebrates that part of my personality and my life and that passion. And I get to sit down with, like, my friend who I, you know, connect with over food the most, more than anyone, and get to talk about it with him and different guests, and it just feels, yeah, ridiculously fortunate. And with that first episode, that we did just land on a whole bunch of things that have stuck, and that's still part of the podcast. So like, yeah, like you do think, okay, that's there now, and while that continues to be there, because who knows, you know, it might not last forever. It might be more short-lived than we want it to be. You just don't know. But at the minute, it means that with anything else, I can just choose if I want to do it or not. And I don't have to go, Yeah, okay, yeah, I'll be on that show, I'll do that thing.
Is that... presumably people, perhaps you guys, perhaps other people have approached you with, hey, let's put this on TV.
Yeah.
Is that a thing? Is that a thing I don't know about? Or maybe is that already happening?
No, nothing's happening. We've been approached about it. And, you know, the short version is that there's never something that... it's just never right, what the person wants to do. Usually, obviously, they want to change the format a bit, which is fine. I think you would have to, because otherwise...
Genie costume.
Yeah. CGI budget would be pretty high. But, like, I think it's just like, yeah, otherwise, if you're doing the same thing on TV as the podcast, I think that makes it redundant. And then and then you're spreading it too thin, and you're going to lose podcast listeners, and neither of them will do very well. So you do need to change it and do a different format to it. And we've got a format that we want to do, but it's not glitzy and exciting enough on the page to be able to sell. You know, a lot of production companies, a few production companies coming up to us and saying, we want to do an off-menu show, here's our idea. And it's like something that on the page seems like exciting, but we know it wouldn't work. We know that it would be, that show wouldn't be good. I wouldn't want to watch that TV show. Whereas, you know, the kind of food shows I love watching, you know, I grew up watching Man vs. Food and Drivers, Dine-ins and Dives and whatever. I don't want to be like those dudes. But I love the simplicity of just, we're going to a local restaurant and we're getting to know the people there and what their best dishes are. Like, that's all our podcast is, but a chat. So, like, I think that's the thing, is that we just never have found someone who wants to make the thing we want to make. And we know what we would want to make as well. But we've talked about making it ourselves. You know, we've got friends... obviously Turtle Canyon, who can make the kind of show that we would want to make, but it would just be about finding the time. But increasingly now, and obviously, you know, I don't need to tell you this because we're here with all this stuff, but doing stuff off your own back just feels like the way to go a lot more. And you do just kind of go, we can do this by ourselves. And it feels silly that we're pitching it to all these people to get it onto TV, when TV, what even is that now? And, you know, more and more you're like, it just seems like people don't care what platform it's on. If it's good, if you make a good thing, they will go there and watch it. So how about we just make sure we make it really good, and then it would do well. So if we've got time, we actually tried to figure out a way of doing it on this tour, on my tour. You know, and doing a thing where we'd go around filming this idea for the show, but couldn't make it work. It's, you know, I would have been absolutely wiped out. It would have been stupid. But, like, if we can find a way of doing it, we'll do it. So I think it'd be great.
I wonder if an element of that is, like, there was a time years ago where a few people were interested in a version of The Comedian's Comedian. And what they would say to me, what they all boiled down to in the end was, can we just have the 5 minutes where they cry? And that was so, like, I mean, that's not fair. I've kind of said that a few times. I'm kind of reducing a few things. It's not entirely fair. But that's how it felt like to me. And that seemed to be the opposite of what I like doing with it.
Yeah.
And I just wonder the extent to which this is a lovely thing whereby with Ben and with Ed, you get to do a thing completely on your own terms. Like, it would need to be so good for you to risk that.
Yeah.
Like, the, you know, the way it's cherished by the audience and all the rest of it. It would need to be so incredible across the board to be bothered with changing something that already works really well on your own terms.
Yeah, why would you? It'd just be a massive shame. And, like, I never listen. Ben sends us the edits every time before putting them out. I never listen to them because I know that he's aced it. I don't have to listen to it. Yeah. I know that anything that I said during the record that I think I misspoke there, or that joke didn't work, or that sounded stupid, he'll get rid of it. Mm-hmm. I know it's not going to be in there because he's just so good at knowing what the show should be. Anything the guest has said, which we think, like, actually, don't want to put that out, he'll get rid of it. He's not in the business of trying to go viral because someone said something slightly un-PC, even if it doesn't represent them, you know, like, he'll get rid of that. And so, like, all of that is great. And I've never had that before with something where you're just like, I know that the person who's doing all the technical stuff here, they're going to nail it, so I don't even have to worry. All I have to do is this bit. So it would seem silly to go, let's make a TV show with... a format that we don't like as much with people that we don't trust as much and get really, really stressed out and end up there on set with them trying to get us to do things we don't want to do, you know.
It's interesting. I think we will probably come back to this idea of the stakes. Like that, like you said, that's an element of the show. What are the stakes now for you? Mm. It's completely fascinating to me. Like you are in this position whereby you get to do what the fuck you want. And we could talk about temps as well. And, you know, the so much of your output now seems to me to be complete. Like, does it feel like that? Like everything you do now is on your own terms. You have complete control of the stakes. Are there any elements to the work you do which don't fit into that? I suppose so one of the things I'm going into, one of the kind of little kind of mental picture I have of where I want to be with my various inventions and entrepreneurial things within or adjacent to comedy. Mm. I'm sort of aiming at being able to walk around the house in tracky bottoms like a dot-com billionaire. Do you know what I mean? It's like someone, one of those guys in Succession, one of the awful people in Succession who like might buy the thing because he's got infinite money. The sort of design your own life concept. Mm. Is that a thing to you? Does that resonate with you? Or does that idea of you being wholly in charge of the stakes, like what does that mean to you?
Yeah, it's weird because obviously that's the goal, or was the goal when I started out. Was like, I just want to be in charge of all this and I don't care about being famous and I care about making stuff that I'm proud of and being able to put it out. And, you know, definitely as an open spot, I was like, most TV is shit. So why would I even want to fucking do that? And, you know, and whatever. And increasingly over the years, I've like, that's changed and I've wanted to do stuff. I want to do as much stuff as possible. And then you're kind of like, you're trying to get stuff made and you're being told no. And that feels bad because you feel like you're not good at that. And you lose your confidence. And I still have massive moments of that and losing. So this feels like a bit of a transitional moment at the minute where I'm getting to do stuff on my own terms and put it out and started doing it independently. But I'm almost waiting on the results of that and how that goes.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So this is lovely James Acaster. Always a joy to talk to him. And what I love about James is he's clearly so ferociously intelligent, but he never makes me feel like I'm stupid. I really like that. Coming up in the set, is that two? That's very beta, isn't it? That's a, what's the, what do people say? What's one down from beta? Gamma? No one says that. It's a quite a gamma thing to say. what I mean is he's charming and a gentleman. And in the second half of this special, we are going to delve into James's self-produced podcast series, Springleaf. We're going to find out what success really looks like from the inside. And we're going to touch on the forbidden topic of money. So James continues to be on tour with Heckler's Welcome. So make sure you get your... Well, you can't get tickets for that. Obviously, it's sold out immediately. He will be doing some dates at London's Harold Pinter Theatre this weekend. There may be returns. I don't know. Perhaps you'll get lucky. For more info, you can go to jamesacaster.com/gigs, which I see as a very humble Keeping It Real gig calendar website address. It's a humble URL and quite befitting. Springleaf continues and so does Off Menu, so get those wherever in Christ's name you get your podcast from. The second part of this special, I should tell you now, is going to drop early next week, or you can watch the full video special now by becoming an insider at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And you should know, there is some more news coming soon about some exciting ways to support the podcast and see a lot more of me. And if you want to see me live, incidentally, before we go into this second part, well, you can't see me live before that, unless you pause pause it. I'm going to be at Leicester. I'm doing my climate comedy show, Spoilers. The strapline, spoilers. It's a climate comedy show, but actually funny and hopefully it doesn't make you feel bad. Someone mash that into a sentence, if you wouldn't mind. That'd be handy. You can find out details about Spoilers, which last year won Best Show at the Leicester Comedy Festival. So this is one of those triumphant return things. You can find out tickets for it at stuartgoldsmith.com. And also, if you fancy going to stuartgoldsmith.com/climate, you can find out a little bit more about some of the climate comedy sessions that I offer to organisations of all sizes. Well, not all sizes. I'm not going to come and do it just for you. I mean, I might do if you're rich enough. Anyway, let's get back to this conversation. James Aylmiston.
At the minute, we're recording an audio sitcom and we're making that. And it's something that I first pitched in 2014 with, you know, Lindsay Fenner and I pitched it to Radio 4 and got told no. And then we tried to get it away at Audible and got told no. And now I'm like, you know, I realised during COVID, I was like, we can do this ourselves. Let's fucking just do it. We believe in this idea. And then you get to do it. You know, a lot of people very generously gave money to it on Kickstarter. And then you start making it and you're like, oh, fuck, now I found out. Now I'm going to find out if it's actually good.
Okay. And, oh, yeah, because it wasn't confirmed that it was good by a producer to whom you pitched it.
You were told, nah, not for us, doesn't work. We're looking for this sort of stuff right now, blah, blah, blah. And you can do all the kind of stuff of like, oh, yeah, they don't want to take risks. This is brilliant. You know, they're looking for this stuff. They want to make this stuff. But at some point, someone's going to come along, make something completely different. Then they'll all just copy that for ages. And while you're right, when you then get to make the thing you want to make, you are like, oh, where's the grown-ups telling me this is rubbish or telling me to rein it in or, yeah, I'm just being allowed to make it. And that's good. But also, you know, you are waiting for, well, I'll get to release it. You know, stand-up obviously is that over and over again with every show. You know, you don't pitch it to anyone. You start developing it and then you take it to festivals and on tour and you find out if it's good or not. And, you know, sometimes you go through that every single night and you're almost starting up again. But like, so yeah, it's. I feel I'm just getting used to it now. I'm getting used to, okay, I get to make these things, but I'm still very. I'm not as confident as I want to be in all of it yet.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I'd say.
Do you? It's interesting when you mentioned that I first pitched this in 2014. Presumably, if that's a thing you've been trying to get away, kind of every so often, there is a point at which, since 2014, you became James Acaster, do you know what I mean? You became like, you started to, what do I want to say? The sort of profile, like to me, as someone for whom your profile is like this kind of towering, you know, if I put this on YouTube, loads and loads of people are watching. Please make that a reality. But do you know what I mean? Like your profile is such that it has this kind of explosive ripple effect on the things that you do. So, well, it certainly seems that way from the outside. Has there been a point at which part of your, like, have you pitched things and been knocked back and part of you's wanted to say words to the effect of, I'm James fucking Acaster. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? Do you have a sense of like, if I say this is good because my repertoire speaks for itself?
Sadly,
can you look down the barrel of the camera and say, I'm James fucking Acaster?
No, because I haven't. So like with scripted stuff, so I've wanted to do scripted stuff for a long time. Because I've not really been able to do it like properly, I did one TV pilot and I did a very short Radio 4 series of like 4 15-minute episodes and a 30-minute pilot for it. So that's all the scripted stuff that I've been able to make and put out into the world proper. And neither of those were successful, you know. Obviously, the pilot didn't get picked up, and the Radio 4 series, you know, I think the pilot that we put out, off, you know, I got good feedback on that, but the series, no one's ever talked to me about it. And then, so then I've been pitching all these scripted ideas for years, and none of them have got away. So I don't think, well, I'm James fucking Acaster, because I'm like, well, this isn't the same. This isn't standard. I'm not saying to them, hey, I want to do a stand-up show and pitching that to them. I'm saying, like, I want to do this series where this happens and da-da-da-da. And there's these characters. And I don't know, I'm not a writer. Yeah, I haven't proved myself in that. So when they say, when these people whose job it is to commission things say to me, no, and they give me their reasons, I'm not, with each one I have, you know, kind of gone, oh yeah, maybe I'm not very good at it. And so like,
because they're saying, I'm a pro fucking juicer.
Yeah. They're like, we fucking know what we're doing. We made this, we made that, you know. And you do think, you know, I watch loads of TV myself, and there is so much stuff where you go, that's made by someone who has proved themselves in multiple arenas and now they've been given a TV series and it's shit. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't think I'm an exception to that. So therefore, like, with all that stuff, I've definitely, like, part of the reason why I wanted to make this audio sitcom was like, I need to just do something and make it and get it out there. So I think I'm just going to give up on this, and I don't want to give up on it because I love the, you know, scripted stuff, and I love the idea of creating that world and getting to tell a story of multiple characters and multiple cast members. And I just wanted to, especially during, you know, the pandemic, I was pitching a lot of stuff over Zoom to people and just feeling like, all that stuff you said, none of that matters. I felt like I'm a fucking, just, I felt like I'm going into this, not just stuck in nobody, but like a bit of a joke. Like I'm going like, I think I could be, I could make a series, and they're like, hmm. And I'm like, and it just never.
Is there any basis in reality to that? Like,
I don't know.
Do you know what I mean? Has anyone ever kind of squid, like, have you ever seen that face that you just did?
I've seen this face as I'm talking on Zoom, and they're not even, and they're just like, oh yeah. I've seen that.
Really?
And you're like, oh, okay, they're not really listening to this, and they're not, and they've already decided. You can tell there's a point where you start pitching, and you can kind of tell the point where they're going. And they've got things they're looking for. So they might, you know, part of their job, I guess, is that they have to sit down and say to each other, what are we looking for at the minute?
Yeah.
What stuff do we want? So when you go, okay, so it's a crime-based, no. That can happen. Sometimes they haven't had that discussion. They don't know what they're looking for. And so you're kind of completely effed. Like, that's not going to, you know, they don't know what they want. And you start talking and they're just like, this is a pointless meeting. Because, like, after you leave, we're going to go away and go, what are we even looking for, guys? You know, because, you know, now it's weird now having, you know, come up. There's a lot of commissioners now and producers who I've come up with.
Yes.
And
yes, I was going to ask about that. You see people who used to be flyers or techs at Edinburgh, and they now run enormous departments and things.
Yeah, you can have frank conversations with them because you've known them for a long time, and they can. And sometimes they'll go, "I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't know what we're looking for, and they won't even let me do anything." And you're like, "Oh yeah, this is," and then you stop taking it as personally. You do kind of think, "Okay, it's But then that's, you know, that reinforces the doing it yourself, and especially with this audio sitcom, you just go like, we can do this. It's an audio sitcom. We can make this. So let's just do it.
One of the things I find really sort of impressive and inspiring is the extent to which you don't need to keep trying these things. Like, I'm thinking of a particular one, but I'm sure there are several comedians who are, I'm thinking the phrase too big to fail, but that's not quite what I mean. What I mean is someone who's almost painted themselves into a corner by being brilliant at everything they do, such that you think, can you still try new stuff?
Right.
Can you still not try new stuff? Or is that a colossal risk to your ego or to your oeuvre or whatever, you know, the public perception of what you do? Right. Because, like, you know, for you to take the risk on Springleaf, on the, which is it still called Springleaf? To take the risk on that is, it does represent you going, I am sitting pretty over here on stand up and off menu, and I'm prepared to go out and possibly risk a public failure, which I'm sure won't happen. But you know, but it's that's the risk. Point. That's the sphere, isn't it?
And what that means to you, you have different. We all have our own version of what the failure, what's a failure and what isn't, as well. You know, based on how well you want it to do, so you know, it could do well, but I still feel like, you fucked it, you know, and it's not, you know, maybe it's not the thing you want. You know, a lot of the time, that's really the main thing for me is that, you know, if I listen back or read it back or whatever it is, and it's not the thing I wanted to make, then that feels like a failure.
Is that the parameter? Because I would imagine that financial compensation or the deal or what have you, or the download numbers or the reviews are less important to you now. Is it? Mm-hmm. Are you completely detached from all those things and it's purely about, did I do what I set out to?
Yeah, but I mean, they're consolation. If you make something that's not as good as you wanted it to be, and you feel like...
this pile of accidental shit is incredibly popular.
So when you go, okay, well, that's done well enough. You know, because I'd say the things that I wasn't that happy with, none of those have become the things that do really well. You know? But they might do... You go, well, you know, it got commissioned or whatever. I got paid for it. I tried my best. I definitely wasn't lazy. I fell short of what I wanted to achieve. People aren't that fussed about it. But let's move on to the next thing. And sometimes I can wallow in it. You know, if you there are things, you know, that might trigger like a big old wallow fest where, like, you know, you have a gig that you didn't enjoy and then you go into, oh yeah, and that thing wasn't good and people don't even give a shit about that thing that I made, even though I'm proud of it. And you can, you know, wallow for a bit and then, you know, speak to someone who cares about you, who will go, shut up and stop doing that. But yeah, I mean, you know, I've never really had a head for all the figures and the numbers and whatever. When I started stand-up and I was losing money all the time, and I just turned off a part of my brain that thought about that, and I think I've lost whatever key is meant to turn it back on, because I don't really... It's like those numbers, I don't understand them almost. They're very abstract when it's... Mm. You know, when Ed and Ben in the early days were like, we've had this many downloads, I was like, I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's good or not. I don't know what the thing is, you know. So,
Do you think, is that partly an attempt to protect yourself on some level? Because you've done it long enough now that you get the sense, even if you don't know the numbers as a percentage of human beings available in the world, I wonder if that kind of... It reminds me of the way I think that, or I try to look at reviews. Oh, I don't read them. But I love to tell everyone I don't read them because they're so fantastically important to me. Do you know what I mean? There's an element whereby my behaviour is to protect myself. I wonder if it does protect you to sort of have a rule in your head that the numbers are meaningless.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's been that conscious, really. But, like, definitely it's probably more just a privileged position to be in. Like, when I started stand-up, and the open mic circuit is obviously, like, nuts, and you're performing to, you know, two or three people in a room above a pub, the mic doesn't work, you're as shit as you're ever going to be. But that was better than the gigs I was doing in my band beforehand. So, like, I feel like stand-up has always felt like, even when it's hard, it's like I'm comfortable enough in it that, you know, I'm not too worried. And so, like, I reckon, you know, if I was doing Edinburgh back in the day and, you know, no one was coming to see my shows, I think numbers would matter to me.
Yeah.
But, and in my second year, they did. In my second year of Edinburgh, you know, doing my second solo show, no one really came. And it really got me down, and I was gutted that no one was seeing this show I'd worked really hard on. So I think it's just a privileged thing of us going, like, oh, they're all here, so I'm going to take it for granted, which is a shame, and I think has led to a lot of the behaviours I'm trying to eradicate right now, of not appreciating, oh, I've got a sold out room, and not appreciating that, just going like, well, yeah, because I'm lush. but then I don't believe that at the same time.
Yes.
So it doesn't really, it's a weird one.
Yeah. It's the, like, your expectations are so, like, quite reasonably, if you've been selling out for however many years now, like, that would change your... I imagine it's like suddenly being, your words, loaded to fuck. Like, I mean, I'm sort of interested. We don't have to talk about that if it's eggy. We'll almost never talk about money on the podcast. But I'm sort of... You mentioned it on stage. In a really interesting context about, the pandemic and the way that celebrities took their enormous privilege for granted, which isn't something you do. But I just wondered, like, what's your relationship to money now? What's it like being loaded to fuck?
I think Ed said... in some interview that I wasn't there for, but he said something like, I've never known someone who cares so little about money stumble into so much of it about me. So, like, it was an accident. It was something that, like, you know, I just wanted to make good stuff, and then, like, that kind of happened, and like, you know, I have accountants and whatever now who I talk to who...
Yeah, you're not like putting it all under your mattress and forgetting that tax exists and all that shit that can come for...
But I'm pretty sure they have their head in their hands after every meeting just going, this guy doesn't understand anything we've just said to him. Like, he hasn't got a clue. It's obviously... just makes me feel incredibly secure and... And like, I think a lot of the, it just de-stresses you and you don't have to worry as much. And that is the way that the world is with capitalism and whatnot, is that it just, it makes life easier for you. And I don't feel comfortable with that all the time. I feel like, and that's why I feel like I should acknowledge it in a show, especially when I'm talking about, you know, going to therapy and whatnot. That's something that I'm doing because I can afford it now. I couldn't afford it when I was growing up, and I couldn't afford it, you know, maybe in the years where I needed it the most, I couldn't afford 50 quid a week to go to therapy.
Yeah.
And now I can, and it's helping me, but I don't want to be going on stage. Yeah. You know, I don't want to be on stage and telling people you can't afford it, so don't bother. but equally I don't want to be going on stage making out like, you know, hey, we should all be doing this.
Yeah.
When some people can't. So, like, yeah, it's something that you kind of adjust to now. She's like, well, I didn't think this would happen. I didn't think I would ever be this comfortable. So now I've got because I didn't plan for that. I didn't have a, you know, dream house or, you know, you speak to people who have like a dream car or whatever. I'd never had anything like that. I was just like, I want to make this show or I want to do that thing. So now, yeah, you're kind of going like, okay, well, what do you want to do with this money? And also, you know, how do you want to, this does change who you are on stage now. This changes your status with the audience. And like, I always really like Rob McElhenney from Always Sunny in Philadelphia is very good in interviews when he's talking about certain things about like, oh no, I was able to get ripped like this because I'm rich. You know, like, because he's aware of like, everyone listening to this can't necessarily achieve that. And he wants to make it clear to them, like, no, no, you would have to literally never see your family, never do anything else, work out all day with a personal trainer who knows their stuff. And you would have to be very, very rich to be able to do that. Mm. And that's how I've done this. And I'm not going to just talk about it like men's health is important and blah, 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 and ignore the fact that I'm able to do this because of that. So, like, I do feel like that with certain bits of this show, especially.
It's funny that you mentioned him being ripped, because my sort of follow-up question was going to be along the lines of, there is this phenomenon now of comics who are designed, like that thing of like, I'm designing my life, people who've made it, like Paul Smith has started doing, you know, mixed martial arts and training and is, you know, massively beefed up. There's someone else who did it recently, Tom Horton, he's been getting really beefy. And I think it's one of those things that comes with, or it probably comes alongside a sort of like, things are working, I've got a bit of free time. Probably, I think in Paul's case, and maybe in other people's cases as well, fans get in touch who are like, hey, you should come to my gym for free because I like you. And then they start teaching them mixed martial arts. I don't know if that's happened to you or you fielded those kind of approaches. But it is that weird design your life thing whereby I sort of notice it. Or do you recognise that kind of trope of like, comic, self-made, doing really well, starts doing mixed martial arts and getting buff? And I'm just always wondering, what is that about? Is it to do with wanting a feeling of security? Because maybe these people are in environments where they're famous and everyone knows they've probably got their wallet on them, and so they're more vulnerable. Like that guy who's been in the news recently who's trying to live forever. He's like a billionaire and he's getting blood transfusions from his son. I've done no further research. I think I saw the caption under a picture.
Wow.
I feel like that's a thing.
Yeah.
Whereby people, maybe when you get rich enough and you're self-determining enough, you start thinking, how can I cheat death? Well, I better start doing protein shakes and chlorophyll or whatever.
Yeah, because then you've kind of completed the game.
Exactly. Something. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, what am I? Oh,
I've got all the best weapons.
I don't want the game to end.
Yeah.
And I'd like another level, but I don't want to. Yeah, but whatever it is. Yeah, I guess like, but that's when you're. I guess, and there's loads of different reasons why people would obviously, you know, doing mixed martial arts and looking at, you know, any kind of physical exercise is looking after yourself and it's cool. So like, you know, good on them. the living forever thing. I mean, that the billionaire and the blood transfusions, that is just someone who, yeah, has they've done it, they've got nothing else to achieve for themselves.
Yeah,
and right. So they're like, well, I would like to live forever. And you're like, there are more things you could achieve, but they would just involve benefiting other people, you fucking asshole. So like, you know, so I think that, I think there's that as well. It's like, you know, it takes a lot of work to get to, you know, to where those people are, I'm sure. And then you maybe, and a lot of work towards yourself is, you know, going around on the open mic circuit and trying to make it in Edinburgh and all of that. It's a lot of hard work and it's all geared towards you doing better. And it's not really geared towards anyone else. And you kind of have to, you can't just keep that up forever. I think when you do get in a position where you're quite comfortable, if you're going to keep on just serving this and ego or whatever the thing is, you probably, I reckon that's probably dangerous and you should, But exercise and stuff is different. I mean, that's...
On that, I've been doing, I'm just at the very beginning of doing some ADHD coaching, like being coached by someone who specializes in coaching people with ADHD. Yeah. I'm just trying it out because, I'll try it out. Maybe it'll be useful. I still go through like big kind of imposter syndrome about it. Like, you know, I'm on medication now. I'm like week 4 of medication. It definitely has an effect, but then it would on anyone. It doesn't prove that I've definitely got it. And it's all, you know, it's a source of confusion for me. But in taking on this ADHD coach, I didn't realize that one of the opening things before the actual coaching can start, I thought it was going to be like job therapy or like productivity therapy, where you get like regular meetings with someone who's like going, why don't you try doing it like this, this and this? And suddenly, fuck, I'm doing loads. Before we get to that, which I hope is still coming, there's an element of it where you've got to do like, you know, fairly tedious personality test worksheets, all this kind of business. In doing that, I was like really resentful and like, God, I don't want to do this. Just get to cut to the good stuff.
Yeah.
In doing it, I've sort of ended up going, it's helping me, I hope, to realize, as I have been for some time, that I've spent, just as you say, like most comics, it's about you, it's inward looking, it's shining the torch on yourself the whole time. I need to increase my productivity, my gigging, my, you know what I mean? And then, and it's capped off by this experience of walking on stage and they clap and they laugh and people tell you you're great, ideally, or they don't, and then you go off and have a crisis about you, you know, oneself.
Yeah.
It's all inward facing. And I wonder, in feeling like, what are your goals? What are the things you want to achieve? And like, basically, I'm ending up with my goals are do a lot, focus on myself a lot less, focus on work a lot less, be less narcissistic, focus on my family, focus on my wife, focus on my friends, and also turbocharge the business and also kind of grow everything.
Yeah, yeah.
How are you with your... With that, with turning the flashlight on yourself, in your kind of journey thus far as a comic and what you anticipate going further, you've been as subject as any of us to those, and certainly more, I would think, writing shows about yourself, about your experiences, being a public person, everyone having an opinion. It kind of like, if you start thinking, if someone in your position starts going, it's kind of all about me, this, everyone's going to agree with you. So how are you with that at the moment?
Yeah, I don't know yet. It's because I feel like this show, I guess a lot of us with our stand-up shows, it just tends to be often just the show that you have to do rather than, you know, necessarily sitting down and going, I want to do this next. I felt like I had to do this, like a show that was about this, but I've been very aware while doing it. I was like, this is really, really just about you. This is just like me, my life experience, and that's it. And that's fine to a point, but I was like, but I have thought while doing it, like, maybe moving forwards it would be good to not, to have a bit more of an outward facing show in the future if you do another one after this, and that's not just all about you and what's going on with you, because we've got to the point now, and sometimes I feel like, yeah, you paint yourself into a corner where you're like, I am talking about literally the thing we're doing right now. Like, I'm just talking about stand-up and being on stage in front of them, and that's the show. I don't know where there is to go now, you know. And then you feel a bit like, fucking hell, man, come on, there's a whole world and a whole bunch of stuff. There's fucking massive issues in the world right now. and you're not touching any of those. You're just going on about you on stage and how it feels. So yeah, I would like to. Sometimes I think you feel like you've reached the end of a certain chapter or whatever it is in your stand-up. And I think moving forwards, I'd like to do stuff that's a bit different and isn't so much just shining the torch at yourself. So what's nice about Off Menu is we get to interview people, so it's about them each time. So yeah, I think like, I don't know what those projects are yet necessarily, but like it would be cool to, because even, you know, the audio sitcom is about James Acaster, the stand-up comedian who's always been an undercover cop, but it's still like me in stand-up. And so you're still kind of, there's that quality to it as well, which I think is cool. I think that's where I am at the minute. But I do feel like, yeah, we're getting to the end of that and we'll see what's next.
So that was James. We've got the second half of this. We're going to talk about the second half of this episode is dropping in a few days. If you're in the Insiders Club, of course, you'll have that immediately and on video. We are going to talk next time about the development journey of James's latest show, Heckler's Welcome. We're going to talk about the idea of a perfect audience, whether that's real or not. And we're going to deal with some of the inner crises of being a comedian, not to mention what passes for hot gossip in mine and James's worlds about Ghostbusters, Bo Burnham and that Oscars moment. That's all coming up in the next episode, which if you are not an insider, you will get in a few days. If you are an insider, check your feed now and you can even see the whole thing on video all in one go. Look at that. You can check in with the podcast Springleaf and Off Menu. You don't need me to tell you about those. And if you're feeling lucky, go to jamesacaster.com/gigs and see if you can get some returns for Heckler's Welcome. All right, gang, join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders and get tickets for my show in Leicester on the 22nd of February from stuartgoldsmith.com, unless it's not the 22nd of February and it's something else I said. No, it is. I see it there. Well, that's when it is, the 22nd of February. Let's all hold hands and hum it together. No postamble this week because I am involved in a long-term, deep, deep project that I should be doing now. And even this counts as procrastinating away from it. But it's cooking. Oh, it's cooking. And when I can tell you about it, oh, man, I'm going to tell you about it. So for now, I will simply say a very happy new year to you all. And wouldn't it be nice in 2024 to maintain a consistent sense of self? Bye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.